Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for MacBreak Weekly is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is MacBreak Weekly, episode 94, for June 18th, 2008, Sprout Core. MacBreak Weekly is brought to you by Audible.com. For your free audiobook, visit audible.com/MacBreak. And by Drobo, the intelligent automated data storage device. To learn more and receive an instant $50 off your own Drobo, visit drobo.com/MacBreak. And by listeners like you. Thanks for your donations. It's time for MacBreak Weekly, ladies and gentlemen, the show where we discuss, dissect, and analyze every last tidbit of morsel of information or non-information about Apple and Macintosh we can ever get our hands on. And we've got a great team of people to do that for you this week, starting with Andy Anatko from Boston. Hello, Andy.
Hello, Leo. Please ignore the pounding. It's that telltale heart, you know. Just ignore it. It'll go away on its own.
You brick it up. You'll cement it in. It just keeps on ticking, doesn't it?
I'm serious. I mean, that FedEx driver, even cut up into 9 pieces, he's twice as annoying as he was in life.
Let me out! Let me out of here!
You know why you're down there. You know why you're down there. Shut up.
Just...
I'm sorry. I can only apologize. I'm sorry.
To prevent any police action, we might mention this is actually a roofer on Andy's roof. Also, just because I don't want them coming to get you, because I've learned now you can't joke in a podcast because people take you seriously.
Yes, we were only joking.
There's always one person who says, Andy Anatko has a body in his cellar. I heard it. Okay. In Minnesota.
Once again, I'm broadcasting to you live from the glorious Mom's Resort and Casino in downtown Boston, Massachusetts, and we're having a new roof put this week.
So raid Mom's if you've got a problem.
Yeah.
Also here, I'm really glad to have him here. We should get him on more often. The Buffet of all Mac knowledge, Mr. Mac 911 from Macworld Magazine and the Apple Phone Show, Chris Breen. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Leo. I've got nothing but live bodies around me, so I've got one up on Andy. Although having a reanimated body in your cellar is pretty impressive.
I think there's some question about whether it's dead or alive, to be honest with you. It sounds pretty lively.
Yeah, but in 9 pieces, I'm thinking zombie.
Brains. I want brains. Also with us, Scott Bourne from the Apple Phone Show and the iLife Zone and Girls Gone Geek and about 18 other... You're doing a new girls podcast, aren't you? Did somebody tell me?
Mom's Gone Geek. That's the new one starting Sunday.
I like the idea. Who did you get to do that?
We've got two moms. They're very high tech, and Liana is going to interview them style sort of. So the two moms are remote, and Liana is not a mom, but she's going to interact with the moms.
I love that.
It's kind of cool. And by the way, instead of saying all my shows, I've found a way to just truncate that for you, Leo. Just say from scottbourne.com. Oh. I've opened up a Tumblr account where I list everything I'm involved with. It's just much easier.
That really is a way to go. Scott, B-O-U-R-N-E, like the born identity.com.
And I want to point out that I pass a strip club every day on the way to work that has a sign that says hundreds of beautiful live nude girls. So there are fortunately no dead ones there.
Thank you for making sure of that. You're right.
What are they? Clubs in New York.
That's what they want you to think.
And that is Daniel Aaron, who is the author of Roughly Drafted Magazine at roughlydrafted.com. It's good to have you back, Daniel.
Great. Thanks. If there's any pounding on my end, I think it's PD&E looking for Jimmy Hoffa under the street outside.
Are you in the Meadowlands?
No, I'm in San Francisco, and they're doing the burying the power lines.
Ah.
Project all over the city.
Oh, that's great.
It's 2008.
We'll be this is Gavin Newsom's plan to beautify San Francisco. First the gay marriages, then the power lines. It's going to be a pretty San Francisco. Did you see Mr. Sulu?
He was one of the first.
It was
George
so cute.
Takei.
He said, what did he say? It was really...
Takei.
Huh? Takei.
George Takei, please.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And please, because Andy does the perfect George Takei.
I thought maybe Andy could do George's wedding vows. So maybe a little later on, I'll ask you to kind of do a dramatic recreation.
He got married?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know.
Getting married. No, he got married.
Khan is going to be giving one of the people away, and his best man is Chekhov.
Is that true?
No joke. That is true.
That is so cute. That is so cute. So the Starship Enterprise really was a much more hot and happening place than we really realized.
it was actually the model for Studio 54.
It's a really real party on there. All right, Mac News. The reason one of the many reasons I love having Daniel on, one of the reasons Daniel's on, though, is he wrote a very good article in Roughly Drafted magazine this week about something that happened last minute Friday at WWDC. It was like Apple was keeping it kind of under wraps until the end of the show. And I think in some ways, not only the most important announcement of the show, but could be Apple's most important announcement of the year, in my opinion, eclipsing the 3G iPhone. It was all about Sprout Core. Sprout Core. Can you tell us what, in a nutshell, what Sprout Core is, Daniel?
Well, Sprout Core is a framework for building applications on the web. It makes it easier for developers to do all the kind of underlying heavy lifting stuff that they need to do to make applications that work more like desktop applications, but run in your browser. And so in doing that, it's kind of an alternative to some of the new technologies that have been getting a lot of play. Microsoft Silverlight, Adobe Flash has a platform called Air, Adobe Integrated Runtime, I think. They're all trying to repurpose these kind of animation things to create full-fledged applications that run in your browser. And what Google and Apple are doing is kind of delivering the same premise, but using web standards as opposed to using a kind of a, having to install a plugin and running it within kind of a proprietary environment.
Even Java, which is Sun's, but Sun has opened it, is still a little more proprietary than some people would like. I mean, the beauty of this is it's completely open source. In fact, Sprout Core wasn't made at Apple, was it?
Sprout Core was designed by a company called Sprout It for one of their own applications. And Apple, this isn't actually brand new stuff. They announced last fall when they came out with the Web Gallery in .Mac that it was kind of quietly announced on the Sprout It blog that that Apple had been working with the developer of this Mailroom application to develop a new application for .Mac within Sprout Core. And so they just kind of presented Web Gallery as a... I think Jobs kind of presented it as being an alternative to using iDVD. You can now publish your videos to the web. And there wasn't a lot of information on how they actually did it. But that was, what, 6-7 months ago? And just recently, of course, at WWDC, there was a big announcement that .Mac was turning into MobileMe. So there's all these different applications, and a number of them were built using Sprout Core. And it's a newer version of Sprout Core, so they have expanded features.
So let me tell you why I think this is a really an important announcement for Apple. You're seeing Microsoft kind of acknowledge with Microsoft Live Mesh and Silverlight that desktop applications and even desktop operating systems are going to be less important going forward. Microsoft, by hiring Ray Ozzie and focusing on Mesh, is really saying we think rich internet applications are the future, you know, things like Gmail and Writely and even Hotmail, and of course some of the applications that Microsoft has at Microsoft Live are the future. Adobe's doing the same thing, taking Flash and making it better and better for application programming. In fact, one of my picks a couple of weeks ago was a Flash-based word processor. People are using more of these online all the time. And everybody else, Google especially, is saying, look, this is the future, is online applications. But the thing that Apple's been doing, I think, is very interesting because quietly, while everybody's making a lot of noise about this, they've been, you know, they hired this guy. They took Sprout Core in-house. They have been enhancing it, and it essentially is bringing Cocoa. And here's why it's really interesting. Cocoa programming, model view controller, standard framework, Rails-style framework programming to the internet. And it explains why, for instance, they've been so anxious to get Windows users to adopt Safari. Explains why Apple has said no to Flash on the iPhone. They don't want a closed world. Daniel, you point this out in your article. They don't want that closed world of anybody like Adobe or Microsoft dominating again. They'd like it to be open. And I have to say, I think this is a very smart strategy on Apple's part, and it really puts Apple applications squarely on Windows as well as everywhere else. Does that seem overstated to you, Daniel?
No, I mean, I think as time goes on, a number of people have pointed out kind of the obvious next step for Apple is to create more applications within .Mac. And I suggested, you know, why wouldn't they use the same kind of strategy that they did with the iPhone, you know, making applications available in a central source and doing the same thing for .Mac, where they bring in third-party applications to either make .Mac or MobileMe more attractive to subscribers or add applications that you could, you know, alternatively subscribe to. And that's kind of that service as a software as a service model is something that a lot of people have tried. And, you know, there are companies that are built all around that, like Salesforce. But on the consumer side, it's almost unheard of. I mean, there's free applications, you know, Gmail and things like that, that people can use that are ad supported. But very few people have been able to convince subscribers to actually pay for their services. There's a few examples like Flickr where they have. But Apple is really kind of leading in that regard of being able to make something that's attractive enough for people to actually want to pay for.
Does this?
Can I take the role of Alex Lindsay if he were here?
Yes, Mr. Skeptic.
This is a Flash killer.
I hope it's a Flash. I mean, as much as I like Flash, I don't want Adobe to be dominant as they are. I don't want Apple to be dominant, but this is not an Apple-specific project. It's open source.
I think Alex tries to see pretty much everything as a Flash killer.
He doesn't like it, does it?
He's progressed, though. He used to say text edit was a Flash killer. So.
Would this eliminate the need for QuickTime as well, or you would use QuickTime in conjunction with this? Is it, in other words, it's just this expose kind of the core video, core animation, and all that stuff?
Well, Flash does a number of different things. The three main things that it does is animate little ads on the web. So right. It's used for, that's kind of what it was its original intent was. And then it became, there was such a problem trying to figure out how to install QuickTime plugins or right. Windows Media plugins. And as things went back and forth, Adobe kind of came out with this framework for playing video within Flash. And that really took off. And, you know, it's the basis of YouTube. And a lot of the sites on the internet are using a Flash-based video player client because it runs on every platform. So right. It's very easy to deploy video because it was really hard to do it before. So that's one other application of Flash that's really popular. And then the final thing is creating whole applications. So Sprout Core is really aimed at the creating whole applications part of what Flash does. There's a lot of toolkits already that allow you to do kind of animated, you know, spruce up your website with kind of interactivity on a simpler level, right. Things like Prototype or Scriptalicious. Those already exist.
In fact, Apple uses Prototype and Scriptalicious, right. I think, on its site.
On their own site.
Yeah. And then there's a Yahoo user interface elements, which is a pretty cool thing as well. Which all of these are using JavaScript, though, right?
Yeah, the Yahoo YUI and there's a Dojo toolkit that does kind of similar things for creating application type things that are done entirely in JavaScript. And there's also the 280 North.
Well,
they're doing kind of a similar
thing. I was going to bring this up. Yeah, because we talked to Francisco Tomalski of 280 North yesterday, and 280 Slides was my pick of the week last week. And they're trying to do the same thing, which is basically bring Objective-C to the web.
Right. I mean, that's a different model for doing kind of the same thing. Yeah. I think they call it Objective JavaScript.
Right.
Where it's kind of the Cocoa model for developing entirely in JavaScript.
They say that the problem with Sprout Core is you still have to do a lot in JavaScript. And nobody wants to write in JavaScript. That's a nightmare.
Apple's doing some of the stuff in the development of applications in Ruby, and then it creates the JavaScript for you.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, because Ruby uses a lot of... In fact, any Ajax framework uses a lot of JavaScript. That's really how you do it. So
it's kind of interesting that with .Mac, you know, they kind of started .Mac as being a server-side service, and it really showed off the power of web objects. They were right. creating a lot of kind of thin applications. Remember when iTools first came out, in the first few versions of iWeb, they were creating a bunch of applications like iCards and the, you know, the online create a website thing. That didn't go over terribly well because the applications were somewhat limited and, you know, people didn't quite get it wasn't obvious how to use all those applications. And then it's kind of turned into kind of a syncing system. So the .Mac has, you know, various web services. It has some web objects based programs, but now it's getting deeper in the client end. So Apple's pairing kind of the web objects back end and I believe they use Sun servers for their email messaging and web dev servers for iDisk file sharing. And they're putting a nice interface on all those various different server backend things with the Sprout Core apps. So what consumers see is a really kind of sharp, nice online app suite that feels kind of like Microsoft Office. I mean, you have all these different components of it that all work together and are all kind of obvious, easy to find. You don't have to navigate to find the features. It's just right there. So it looks like it will be an interesting to see how the market responds to that.
What was their come on to developers when at the, I know you weren't there, but if you were, I guess you can't really talk about it, can you?
Apple's come on to developers.
Yeah. I mean, what was their pitch? Did they say, look, we're going to make this easier for you to write applications, not just for the iPhone and for Mac, but for everything? I mean, I guess that's the promise of this, isn't it?
Well, of course, Sprout Core was developed to deploy across platforms. So the company that created it, Charles Jolly is the main developer there. He built it to create the app that they were working on, Mailroom. It's a mail sorting application. And I thought it was interesting. One of the things they pointed out was that the Obama campaign started using it. They were real excited about it when the campaign was just starting to get off. And then also apparently the McCain campaign is also using it. I've heard from other sources. So
how interesting.
So everybody has been using this the Sprout Core application that was kind of a secret in the presidential race. I mean, that kind of just goes to show that, you know, this is an experimental technology. This is something that's being used in production in kind of, serious situations.
Andy, did you read the article? Did you have any thoughts on this and its importance?
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting in that it made me realize that I was totally wrong about at least one piece of speculation, because lately I've been trying to figure out exactly, two, 3 years later, why Apple was bothering supporting a version of Safari for Windows.
Yeah.
Given that there's really, I can really comfortably say that there's really no advantage to using Safari compared to, obviously to Firefox, but even compared to Explorer, it's just not as good a browser. And one of the things that was sort of in the back of my mind is that maybe they're trying to sort of have a sneak API, sort of like a sneak development platform, so that if in the future they wanted to deploy a local version of iPhoto or a local version of iCal, they wouldn't have to start from the ground up because they have all the gears and all the mechanisms for supporting like Cocoa-based apps already in Windows, based in QuickTime and based in the Safari engine. And so my antennae twitched a little bit when I first read about this, thinking, "Oh, there it is! It's come to fruition. This is actually they're now starting to deploy all this stuff as OS independent." And then I read further and realize that no, you don't need a special browser; it runs on anything. Obviously, I was just making noises with my mouth when I was speculating about that. it does look great. I mean, when you look at the demo apps here on SproutCore.com, you see what looks like a quick and dirty version of iPhoto that's running right here in Firefox.
Right.
And you're sort of, you almost want to see somebody really try to break Sprout Core just to see how far they can push it before it starts to fail. Because if a teenage friend of mine said, "Hey, I just started learning Cocoa. Here's something that I did over the weekend," I wouldn't question it for a second as a regular responsive desktop Cocoa app.
Right. It's pretty impressive. It's pretty amazing. Chris Breen, have you been following this at all, the Sprout Core revelation? To me, this is like Apple buried the lead. This is
I really am impressed by this, and it is sort of the answer to Larry Ellison's challenge many, many, many years ago, is how are we going to put all our apps on the web and make them accessible to everybody? And clearly the response is not to give one company the responsibility for doing all of this, but rather do something like this where you've built the better mousetrap and it's available to a lot of people. My one concern about this is knowing the reliability of .Mac, I would hate to see this undercut because Apple can't deliver the infrastructure to keep this live all the time. Those of us who've had .Mac in the past understand that there are times it just goes down and it's gone for a long time and Apple doesn't explain very well what happened. It just happens to be gone. And now they're going to open this up to Windows as well. And I would think they're going to be having to absorb a lot more bandwidth because of it. And you want to make sure this thing is rock solid instead of sort of .Mac-ish.
Here's the thing that's kind of interesting. It's unlike the thin clients of web objects, it's a thick client, right, Daniel? So in a way, like Google Gears, in fact, you're seeing this now already in Firefox 3, the ability, and Fluid app, which we talked about last week, was Andy's pick last week. We're more and more able to see these things work offline as well. Does Sprout Core do well if you can't get onto the server?
Well, one of the things that Sprout Core is kind of aimed at doing is delivering that, what you're talking about, this the offline work, which is one of the, you know, main flaws of a web application is if you lose your connectivity,
yeah,
your
you web can't do it on an airplane.
Stuff working.
Yeah.
Right. So part of the HTML5 spec relates to how do you do applications like this and how do you make them so that they can unplug and work kind of locally and then plug back into the server when it becomes available, just like a mail app or any kind of desktop app would do. And that's one of the things that Sprout Core addresses is how to accomplish that. And it does things in kind of a standardized way. So rather than this being like an entirely new platform that kind of expects developers to do things the Apple way, this is kind of doing things in the JavaScript way. So they can mix and match this with other open tools that create JavaScript apps. And, you know, Sprout Core isn't the only way to do this. This is kind of an interesting example that because Apple's behind it for their own for the mobile me stuff, but there's a number of different toolkits that people can use, and this should bring more competition into the space and create more attention around that. Instead of, I mean, kind of the easy thing to do now is to say let's do something in Flash because it's available now, but there's certainly an opportunity to kind of divert resources like you're talking about, putting this into an open framework so that anybody can develop JavaScript apps. Anyone can implement a JavaScript interpreter for the browser.
And by the way, if you want to install Sprout Core and play with it, it's literally a one line terminal command using Gem. And since most Macs have Ruby installed, is there Ruby involved, or is it, they just use Gem, the Gem installer, to make it easy?
They use the Ruby is used to install it, and it also makes use of it in the development when you're developing.
As you said, it uses Rails a little bit, or?
Well, yeah, you use Ruby to do some things that you don't have to like write out all the JavaScript, and then when you set up the app, then you end up with pure JavaScript. So in some ways, it might be somewhat similar to the Google toolkit. Right. Where in Google's case, you're actually doing it in Java, and then it creates JavaScript out of it, which is unrelated.
So if you have an administrator account, I have access to one, just do sudo gem install Sprout Core, and there it is. In fact, the Hello World application is pretty straightforward and looks pretty cool. I have to say, I'm impressed. Daniel, are you a little bit of a developer yourself? Do you write software?
I've done some. I've done some web objects work.
Okay, so you're familiar with this, the whole concept here.
What's interesting about the Sprout Core stuff, one of the things that I thought was interesting is the localization features, where you can quite easily set up localization just as you would in a Cocoa app, where you just add the localized strings, and then all of a sudden your web app is just available to run in other languages as clients hit your web server.
How does this compare to 280 North is doing? When I asked Francisco, he said, well, you don't have to use JavaScript so much with ours. You still have to know JavaScript for Sprout Core. Is that your experience?
I don't have a lot of experience with 280. I was actually referring to them as 420, which
it's the
which
highway.
It's not their name.
It's the highway, 280.
But yeah, it sounds like what they're doing is kind of, they call it cappuccino, I believe.
Right.
Kind of wrapping JavaScript in this objective layer.
Well, their idea was JavaScript and Cocoa, and somebody pointed out that's not a cappuccino, dudes. That's a mocha, but they don't drink coffee apparently, so they call it a cappuccino. But yeah, the idea is it's all wrapped in this objective JavaScript, so you're kind of more like a desktop programming environment, I guess.
I played with the what do they call it, slides.
Yeah. 280 slides.
It looks like Keynote, you know.
It's amazing.
It's amazing that this is happening in the web now. And even, even if you look at Flickr, you know, you see a lot of interactivity, but it's not, it's custom rolled interactivity. So it doesn't work like a desktop application, and it doesn't use the same kind of conventions that you expect with a desktop application. So with things like 280 North or Sprout Core or some of these kind of richer frameworks, you can actually build things that work just like a desktop application that have the same kind of scroll bars. And instead of being, you know, having there being a way to select items and put them in groups and, you know, drag them into folders, it works just like the desktop. So it's extremely intuitive for users, and it kind of draws people in. When you make things so easy that you don't have to think about it, it's much easier to get people to invest in it and actually use it.
Yeah. Well, I just wanted to bring this up. I just think this is really interesting. It's in some ways you could say this shows a shift in strategy for Apple, a recognition, as Microsoft has recognized, that the future of applications and even, I hate to say it, operating systems may lie on the internet. And Apple is, all this time, these cagey fellows have got something up their sleeve, and very, very impressive. I'm excited about the future of Sprout Corp. But enough of that, because I can tell it's putting everybody to sleep. So let's. I just think this was a big story. I just think it's very interesting. But let's talk about.
Well, it's definitely like when you hear that they're going to be tearing up the streets for the next 2 months while they upgrade the clay pipes into modern PVC.
Right.
You don't notice it until you realize that, hey, well, the web just got a little bit better. So it's going to take a year or two for this to really filter in where it comes really reliable, something tangible for the users. But you're right. I mean, potentially this could be atom splitting.
Yeah. Do developers seem interested in this, Daniel?
Yes. Every developer that I've talked to about this has really been excited and really kind of responded with, wow, that kind of.
It changes everything.
Yeah, they get it. And so that's kind of. A big part of what got me excited about it is, you know, I can look at technologies and think, you know, this seems important, but when you have people that are doing it for their job, when they say, yes, this is cool stuff, then lets me know what's going on.
Well, and Google,
what I'm most curious about is, though, Apple had the option of just keeping this technology to itself and just using it to make its .Mac services shine that much brighter than anything else that's out there. Or alternatively, when we get into macOS 10.7, macOS 10.8, really blur the lines between desktop applications, desktop OS services, and services that are projected to you wherever you are. It's the obvious answer is that they wanted to make sure that Adobe and Microsoft don't get that toehold in the operating system to make sure that, hey, unless you have this proprietary technology that Apple doesn't own, you're not going to get the full web experience. But I'm wondering how long the debate was inside Apple to figure out what they do with this.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, they're giving it away, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, that's the best way to give something critical mass is to give it away.
There's
really more valuable. It's really more value to Apple to have everyone else using this than to have this as being their own, you know, their kind of own proprietary way of doing things, because the more people using the software, the better it gets. I mean, everybody refines it.
Well, there's a business here, too. You look at what Google's doing with the Google App Engine. You know, Google's giving away, server space and application space. And if you have fewer than a million views a month, it's for free. I wonder if Apple plans to do the same thing with Mobile Me, that if it could be the Google App Engine for Apple. And that is saying let a million flowers bloom all running on Mobile Me. Do you think that's the kind of thing they'll do? Will they open up Mobile Me and let third party developers use these services?
Well, there certainly is a combination there, like I mentioned, between the state of mobile applications for phones has been in just a mess forever, because there hasn't been like a central place to buy things. Prices are kind of all over the place. It's very similar to the state of music before the iTunes store came out.
Yes.
It's easier to steal stuff than it is to buy it in some cases.
Yes.
And so with the App Store, you know, making it just really easy to publish for developers and market their work, makes it very easy for consumers and makes the prices really lower because everyone's paying a little bit instead of a few people, you know, paying a lot and most people stealing it. So this is an opportunity to do the same thing for web apps. You know, they could either, like I mentioned, either make it part of Mobile Me is something that makes it more valuable, or have like a menu that you could, you know, rent QuickBooks for the year for some, you know, annual fee. And it's not only just the web app that you're getting, but the web services. So it syncs with your phone and syncs across multiple computers. And this is really a key thing that Apple's really in position to do. And that there aren't obvious competitors that have lined up all the pieces in the same way.
I think we could look back on last week at some point in 5 years from now, we may look back on last week and say that was when Apple suddenly veered to the left. and brilliantly, I think.
Yeah, I would say to Andy's point that this was not a bad time to unveil this, simply because there were a lot of Windows developers at WWDC last week because of the iPhone.
Yeah.
So they could say, oh, by the way, while you're doing that, we have this little thing over here.
Right.
And then, you know, they're obviously excited about iPhone development. They go, oh, I can do this too. Well, this makes the Mac even more attractive to me. Or that Apple is no longer simply about the Mac.
Right. And you're right. I think we lost him again. But you write once for, let's say you're doing an iPhone app. At the same time, you consider now, well, I can also run on Windows in Firefox or in Internet Explorer. It can also run on the Macintosh. Suddenly, that's a very much more attractive business to go into.
I'm wondering how much this is costing Apple, though. Is this, they bought the company, they bought the technology. Is there going to be an ongoing expense for them to support all these developers, or is this just the sort of thing where, you know, there's a one-time expense, and now we're just going to reap benefits from it.
If I were Steve Jobs, I would get a little building off in one corner of the Cupertino campus. I'd run up the pirate flag and get the best five developers he has on staff and say, guys, this is the new Macintosh. This is the future of the company. Let's be the pirates and do it. I think it's that important.
But can he find within Apple a jerk as big as he was in 1982 to run this operation? That's the challenge.
I think that's another secret development project that they're working on.
I think Steve moves in with him. He moved in with him last time. I think he moves in with him.
That's finally a reality show that I would actually watch.
Living with Steve, yeah.
I would watch
that. He got into the Pixar thing for a reason. They're creating an animated character who will take this job.
Good on his ship.
Well, a curse-filled version of Clippy, the paperclip.
This is your future.
I need to think of a key line that's something other than you're fired or you're the weakest link.
This
is a piece of crap. You should be embarrassed for yourself.
That's good.
I invented the iPhone. Heard of me?
Maybe that's it. Maybe you have a fake Steve Jobs run the whole thing. That might work. All right, we're going to take a break. Come back a week later after the iPhone announcement. We've had some time to think about it. Some of the negatives as well as some of the positives on the iPhone. We'll talk about that just a bit. But of course, I want to mention our good friends at Drobo. Data Robotics Drobo.
Feeling droovy.
We love Drobo. Drobo is
the...
Hail Drobo! Drobo is at its simplest... Somebody sent me an email and said, you know, you guys really shouldn't recommend using the Drobo as your sole hard drive. What if anything happens to it? And we're not saying take the drive out of your Mac and use Drobo. We're saying it's an external USB drive, or you can use it over the network with Drobo Share. And it is huge, but it isn't your primary. You're not booting from Drobo. It's your backup drive. It's where you store your music so that everybody can listen to it. It's where you back up all your photos. The beauty of Drobo is it's as big as you want it to be. It has room for four drives. You can mix and match. It will add the total sum of all those drives. Take about a quarter of it for data redundancy. It's fast. It's efficient. It's easier to use than any other RAID array because you don't have to worry about what drives you're putting in there. As long as they're SATA drives, you just slot them in. Drobo will tell you with the great lights on the front. If you're running out of room, it'll show an orange light for the smallest drive, and you pop a new drive in there. You can go up. What is it? What was the total possible? I think 14 terabytes, something like that. Of course, we don't have drives that big yet, but you can put terabyte drives in there and get 4 terabytes. And now, Drobo, the intelligent and automated data storage device, is $50 less expensive because you're listening to Mac Break Weekly. An instant $50 off if you go to drobo.com, drobo.com/MacBreak. I'm not saying you mail in something. I mean, yeah, everybody else, you can mail in your coupon. We're talking instant $50 off when you go to drobo.com/MacBreak. This offer is good through August 31st. Don't delay. If you've wanted a Drobo all this time, go to drobo.com. Watch Callie Lewis's great video. I think, Scott, are you doing a video, or is it Alex is doing a video?
No, we shot some video for him. I'm not in the video. We actually had one of their engineers. They hired us. This is independent and separately of this particular spot you're reading. They hired us to do it. And just, you know, the engineer is just showing you all this stuff. And he's the same guy that demoed it for me at Macworld. And I said, that's the guy I think you should have on video.
Yeah.
Not that I like looking at Callie, but I mean, this is a guy who, you know, he lives with this thing. And he's the one that convinced me to try it. And, you know, by the way, my entire retirement, which is the equivalent of my 401k, which is my 450,000 image library sitting on a Drobo, and nobody could pay me enough to say that or do that if it weren't true. I'm relying on this thing, so I'm banking on it.
Yep. It's redundant. It's safe. It's best, the best backup device you can buy. I love my little Drobo. It's a little friend, your little friend in the core. You know, you stick it somewhere and it just backs up everything, and it's just so great. I love my Drobo. Get it for $50 off right now and learn more about Drobo. Drobo.com/MacBreak. We thank them so much for their support of MacBreak Weekly. Drobo. I love just saying the name, Drobo. I think I only want to have sponsors that have names that are fun to say. Drobo. Drobo. Drobo.
That's it will most be of too drobotizing if we don't.
I know. Almost though, all the web is like fun to say. Drobo. Meebo. Meevio. Drobo. It all sounds like baby talk. That's the funny thing.
The problem is none of these companies, with the exception of potentially Drobo, none of these other companies will make it onto Wheel of Fortune because they don't have any vowels in their names.
Oh, that's true. It could have been Drobo. No, I need Drobo. I like vowels.
I'd like to buy an O.
Please. Several.
Expensive.
Several O's. All right, let's move on to the iPhone. Now, a week and a half later, we've kind of had some time to absorb it. There's an article on, I guess it's Newsvine, saying what the so-called total cost of ownership argument. But we hear this every time. All cell phones are expensive. If you start talking about the monthly fees, they're going to add up. Only $199 for your 8-gig iPhone. But remember, when you get any cell phone, you're buying a 2-year contract. You're committing, and in this case, probably to something like $60 a month. So it's about $1,250, right? So what?
Yeah,
so
we did a study at Apple Phone Show, and it's cheaper than most of the Blackberries, for instance, on most plans that people are going to have. And it is more expensive, however. This is kind of a cute trick. And Steve announced that the phone is cheaper, and it is cheaper buy-in. But over the course of the contract, it's like $40 more expensive.
Well, that's interesting.
But because it's twice as fast.
that's because Apple's not getting that money. AT&T's getting that money.
That's really interesting. So they actually worked it out by adding, what, $10 a month to the data plan.
And is it a little bit more than that? Because the data plan is a little bit more expensive, the 3G data plan.
Yeah.
But isn't there also no SMS included?
There's no text messages.
The original plan had like some 200 text messages.
Yeah, that'll cost you another $5.
I could blow
bucks.
Past that.
Yeah.
So
Let's stop the madness before it gets a little crazy. I spoke with an AT&T official this morning. Nobody knows the answer to that question publicly. There may be the very same SMS plan included. There may be a different SMS plan. There may be no charge. There may be a charge. AT&T has not publicly agreed to anything you're hearing about the SMS plan. So nobody really knows.
So they haven't said what their new iPhone data plan will include.
Just this morning, I interviewed somebody from AT&T, and they said, we do not know the answer.
Well, one thing that will be interesting is that there's, Apple's always included mail on the iPhone. It's free, as opposed to sending SMS. And they've made all that, if you're sending a picture, you can't even do it over SMS on the iPhone, MMS. You have to do it as an email attachment.
Which is also frustrating.
Well, it's frustrating for if you have somebody that's trying to send you a picture, the AT&T sends you this crazy link that you have to type in. It's really stupid how they do it. But what Apple is doing is kind of pushing you towards the free solution. And going forward, there's going to be a lot of third-party apps, Twitter and various other, IM kind of apps that will hopefully push us past SMS. So obviously,
SMS is stupid. SMS is kind of a holdover from days when phones didn't even have data. But,
right.
But now it's really insulting to be charged 10 cents for 140 bytes of data. That's really insulting.
And if you happen to be, I found out just recently, I had a couple of friends from overseas texting me. It's a quarter if it's outside the U.S. And I think if you're in Europe, it's something like 50 cents to get an SMS.
But I don't know if I agree with you, Daniel, that Apple is encouraging you to use mail or pushing you towards the free thing, because they make their SMS application look like iChat. And I think if you're not paying attention, you feel like you're chatting. And I think Apple, in that respect, is saying, come on, use SMS. It's just like chat.
Well, but see, Apple's not getting paid for that.
Not anymore, but they were.
I know, but I'm just saying.
Now there's no incentive.
Yeah, there's no incentive at all. And the third, and all these things are the kinds of things that we, you know, we had those 5,000 developers in town to take care of. They, you know, they can devote. AOL's already, for instance, said they've got a chat-like thing coming. It'll be there on shipping day, they say. There are several chat type clients that might replace or, you know, completely obviate the need for any kind of SMS. We don't know. But I just, there's a lot of conjecture about the AT&T side of this deal yet, because frankly, AT&T has not publicly proclaimed many answers. I've seen a lot of articles written by people who claim to be in the know, but every time I approach AT&T, they say either that's wrong or we don't know the answer to that yet. It hasn't even been decided. I don't know how they can write it.
Well, that's good to know. They haven't decided yet. Let's put some pressure on them to at least include some SMS messages. I know people say, oh, you'll use chat or you can use email. My kids use SMS. Now, they're not using iPhones. They're on Verizon and other services, but they use SMS. They don't use chat.
I think there's a division within the company, you know, sort of a battle between the people that say, you know, look what people are paying for BlackBerry data. It's consistently more expensive than, you know, the iPhone's data plans, and they think they should be able to get more revenue. And there's other people like, no, we, you know, we included 200 text messages in the last deal. We should do that much. I suspect they're going to come down on the side of including 200 as they did before, and then you can pay $10 more a month for unlimited, which is what I'm doing now.
Chris Breen, do you use SMS at all?
Rarely, and I use it only when I have to talk to somebody who doesn't have an iPhone. So I think we still need it, unfortunately. My sister is on Verizon, and I need to text message her every so often. And you can't. You know, what are you going to do? I can't chat her from my phone because she can't do it on her phone. And, this, you know, I could push her to get an iPhone, but she's locked in right now and she's not ready to do that.
I think there certainly needs to be SMS on the iPhone, of course. And it, like you were saying, the chat interface makes it very easy to send far more texts than you thought you were doing. I don't think I ever have used 200 SMS messages because I was born after, 1980 before that. So I don't send 1,000 text messages a day, but since I got the iPhone, I have been using so many SMS messages that I had to upgrade my plan. But I think it's kind of a strategy, kind of like Apple's approach to Flash, is that if you de-emphasize it in the case of SMS, or if you make it just unavailable, as they did with Flash, that is a market force. It's pushing other users towards using something else.
At 10 cents a message, by the way, data SMS data is $731 a megabyte.
Wow.
Yeah.
that's what I'm talking about. That's a ripoff.
It's more expensive if you just send like a one-letter reply.
Yeah, because it's 10 cents per byte.
That's more expensive than buying a vowel on Wheel of Fortune.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, my concern
check you for the consonants too.
Includes consonants.
My concern's always been what you know, from day one when we started talking about the iPhone before number one shipped, I always said I'm worried about AT&T in this deal. That's the place I've always put my focus of concern, and we got to hope that they're going to do right by us. Now, I was pleasantly surprised with the first package they offered on iPhone 1. I'm not surprised they're raising the price on iPhone 2. First of all, it costs money to build out a 3G data network, and it costs more to use and operate. That makes sense to me. If they raise the price on the SMS, though, I'm going to call BUFA on that one.
Yeah. Yeah, because they kind of have us, you know, by the short hairs there. I mean,
they may not. I mean, what if some developer just comes up with some super cool alternative that makes SMS, you know, unnecessary?
Yeah, but there's a standard, you know, there's a standard concept that you never just hand your enemies a weapon for no good reason. And simply saying that, oh, by the way, the standard data plan includes no text messaging, we're going to pretend that people just don't use it and they don't consider it to be important. I mean, if it doesn't really cause a problem for them to include text messaging inside the regular data plan, to keep that method of communication as elevated as anything else you can do on the iPhone, I mean, they really have to come up with a good reason of why they're cutting that out, or why they're making it more expensive or more difficult.
And I can't figure out a reason, Andy. I've talked to several experts. Can you think of a reason why they would have to?
No idea. Well, it's you try to sniff out the color of the logic whenever you're dealing with two different companies that have to work together. This really does smell like phone company logic as opposed to Apple logic. So this sounds like something that AT&T is doing where they have a free choice to charge whatever they want, and they're simply choosing to create this plan.
They better watch out, because
although it is a little bit in line with Apple's, oh, we don't use that anymore. You know, like,
yeah,
oh,
that's
we don't need iMovie to talk to iDVD anymore because we don't burn discs anymore. Right. And you don't really need a media player on your Air because, you know, who uses DVDs anymore?
Right.
So I actually believe it is the phone company, but Apple has been known to abandon technologies that it thinks are old and in the way.
But only Apple doesn't benefit from SMS. So the idea of AT&T trying to charge extra for it, I think it's kind of like a, you know, when you buy a car and they try and put undercarriage, you know, anti-rust thing on it. So it's just, I think it's a way to get sign people up, say, oh, here's a cheap phone, here's a cheap plan. And oh, by the way, if you want to send text, it's just a little bit more for this, a little bit more for that. And then, you know, by the end of the day, you're paying $90 a month.
That's classic. That's exactly how the phone company operates. They focus on the upfront cost. And they've got a good one. They've got a good upfront cost.
And I think it's kind of interesting that the, remember when the iPhone came out and everybody said, oh, whoa, this is a $2,000 phone because, you know, across 2 months or two years of service, it's so expensive. In addition to being, you know, $600, and nobody was saying, oh, by the way, you know, the cost of a BlackBerry is actually more. The cost of a Motorola Q is actually, you know, a couple hundred dollars more than the iPhone over 2 years because the service plan is more expensive. But as soon as Apple lowered the price to where it looks immediately competitive in terms of the upfront price, now you have people saying, oh, look, you know, the whole price of the iPhone is this, you know, it's not what you buy into it for. So I think that's a kind of interesting that, because that was one of the things that I was pointing out when it first came out is, you know, the total cost of ownership on the iPhone is actually cheaper. Everybody was kind of focusing on the fact that it was, you know, $600 originally, how that was so terribly expensive for a phone.
But when it did first come out, we ran a post on Apple Phone Show where I listed 17 phones that were available commercially you could buy that cost more than $600 at that time.
Yeah, I never bought it.
That's a statistic that I just never got behind. Yeah. I don't think anybody who's walking to a store with money in their pocket is comparing $730 on this contract versus $520 on this other contract. I think they're saying this is a $199 phone. I can afford that. Here's a data plan that will cost me no more than $60 a month. I can afford that. Good. Let's go.
Yeah.
Right. And I thought it was interesting that Apple never advertised that. You know, they never said, oh, look at the cost of the iPhone. It's, you know, this is what I think that would be a marketing kind of death wish is because people think, oh, $2,000 for a phone. I can't afford that over a cost of 2 years. But like what you're saying,
That's why airlines never say we crash less often than our competition.
Yeah. Right.
We only cost a whole lot instead of a whole heck of a lot. I'm pleased to see that United Airlines is adding connectivity for iPods in its planes. This is kind of surprising. I guess if you're paying $1,000 for flight, you ought to at least be able to watch your iPod or listen to your iPod. The connectors in the planes, I don't know if they charge your iPod or not.
I've seen a number of. I think I flew on something. It was a 777. And, you know, they have ports all over the place. It's almost like first class. And one of the things that they have is USB ports.
Right.
Which which is great. Because,
which Virgin
has,
but they don't do anything. So do they, Scott, you fly Virgin. Do those Virgin?
I fly Virgin often. And they're powered.
Those USB ports?
Yeah.
But they're just power.
You can get power out of them and you can hook things from, I mean, in a demo I saw they did it. I've never needed it because I can't get past their, I'm always watching TV on their little thing.
You're
that
playing
comes free.
Doom. So you can't stop playing Doom with the other people on the plane.
Well, and I chat randomly because you can chat.
It's
with
so weird to chat with other people on the plane.
Hi, I noticed you sitting in four.
Hey, baby. Yeah, I'm up here in the front. So can you chat, by the way, if you're in first class in Virgin America, can you chat with the people in the steerage?
You can chat with anybody in the whole plane.
Okay. There's no virtual barrier to prevent the
no virtual barrier.
Commoners from chatting with you. So the
even the common seats are pretty nice from what I hear.
I know. From what you hear.
Yeah, I said a joke.
It was a joke. It was a joke for all the people that hate me.
The last time I flew Virgin America, I went in the back for a moment just to see. I pounded the drum for a little bit, said, row, row. So the 15.4-inch screen, see, this, there you go. There's the sign that this is a plane that you're not going to be flying on anytime soon. You know, in fact, United just announced that they're cutting salaries, they're cutting employees, and they're cutting their fleet. But there is a plane with a 15.4-inch screen at the seat, and it has a connector so you can watch your iPod video or listen to your iPod music. It doesn't say if it charges, though.
Do they charge you like $10 to have the connector cable?
Yeah, 10 cents, 150 bytes.
Yeah.
The Singapore Air is also doing this. You can connect your iPod to the in-flight entertainment system on Singapore Air.
Hey, let me tell you, Singapore Air is so nice, that's the last thing you're going to worry about.
Exactly. L.A. to Singapore and Newark to Singapore. They always do this, though. There's always one plane. Air Canada had one nice plane. And you would always, you know, as you're going, you know, because I flew Air Canada all the time to Toronto. As you're getting on the plane, you're going, please let it be the good plane. Please. And you get on and the seats are kind of gray and you go, oh, no, it's not the good plane.
Well, now don't you sort of expect that stuff? I mean, I remember when that was really, truly newsworthy. But don't you expect, you know, my new car has an iPod connector, sure, and it goes right to the menu on the car. It's not like it just makes it work. It charges it. It integrates the menu system with my audio system. I mean, don't you just sort of expect that now?
Yeah, when you get a new plane or a new car. The problem is getting a new plane or a new car.
Well, you know what I mean. They're just starting to permeate.
It's now the thing. Car. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, so, I haven't been flying as much lately now that gas is so expensive. Oh,
and now they're charging $25 a bag. Can you imagine what it's going to be like?
Well, you know, airlines pay $8 a gallon for kerosene.
Do they really?
Jet A. Well, I mean, the smaller ones, but if you're a private pilot, it's terribly expensive. If you're an airline, you know, you have long-term contracts. But
I'm thinking of driving to Vegas for a podcast expo in August. Anybody want to go road trip?
I'll drive.
Wouldn't that be fun?
Awesome.
The reason is I want to pack all the cameras. I want to pack the TriCast shotgun. In fact, the TriCaster and bring the whole studio down, basically.
I'll come pick you up.
Will you? Let's all go down. It'll be fun. Yeah. I'll help with the driving.
We can have a caravan.
Scott's got one of them newfangled cars where you can plug your iPod in. I can't wait. So excited.
I myself am finally breaking down and having like a real like iPod audio head installed in my car. Because I actually skinned one of my knuckles punching the auto reverse button on my cassette deck once too often when I just randomly decided to flip over to the other side of the car adapter. So just when I'm at the bit of the podcast when they're going to give the punchline of a joke or something really important and I'm listening to nothing, I'll press it lightly once, I'll tap it a little bit firmly the second time. The third time onward, I'm just punching the hell out of that dashboard. It's not good.
Now you have a cassette player in your car, Andy?
Again, I remind you that I'm a freelance journalist in a collapsing market. I have a car that's very sensible for someone who walks 30 feet to work every morning. It's like the standard. It's always been like the standard cassette, like the stock cassette player.
You mean like a cassette player or an 8-track? It doesn't have those buttons where you're pushing the button and it has a clunking sound.
Hey, look, Andy's down. Let's kick him. That'll be fun.
Hey, I'm just wondering when the gray...
I guess Daniel doesn't want his free t-shirt and his free coffee mug for being a guest on the show, does he, Leo?
No.
I was going to share my 8-tracks. I have some carpenters.
Oh, that's different. I might give him a Drobo for that. Wouldn't that be cool if the Drobo had an 8, like at the top, had a little 8-track? Slot, you could just punch your 8-track in there because
it'd be cool if you had some 8-track.
And then like you're reading a file and we'll just randomly switch to the middle of another file with chunk. No warning.
Chunk, like a real 8-track and make a chunk set.
A little wood paneling on it.
I'm ready.
Comes with a free body life knife to keep it working. That sort of stuff.
I'm ready. I'm wondering when the Greyhound is going to have that iPod connector in the back of the seat.
Well, there's some nice bus service that maybe Andy's heard of back on the Eastern Corridor. They're sending ads out here for some reason. I don't know why. But they've got Greyhound and other carriers that are doing New York to Boston and Boston, Washington, D.C., Philly, like real nice buses.
I've actually been meaning to try it. Normally I take Amtrak because it's just such a wonderful way to travel, like from Boston to New York. But there are now luxury bus lines with like not Greyhound buses. It's more like, you know, your P. Diddy motor coach with like black business class leather seats, free Wi-Fi, free Virgin Atlantic style, you know, direct TV in every seat back. It's 3.5 hours. It costs like about a half as much as it costs to fly Amtrak. It'll take you right down to Midtown Manhattan into the Port Authority bus terminal, at which point you disembark and the luxury ends, I'm certain. But it's interesting to see all these solutions. Again, the idea of having that kind of an experience for 3.5 hours and knowing that there probably won't be some like, you know, college grad student drooling and sleeping on your shoulder, you know, for the 3.5 hours, that actually might make bus travel interesting again.
Well, I believe they provide catheters as well.
I could use one right now. I'll tell you what, let's take a little let's take a little mini break. Anybody who wants to go to the bathroom can. And
I'll be back in just a minute.
Go ahead, Scott Bourne. It's time for a visit with our friends at Audible, AUDIBLE.com. Audible is our source for audio books we love. And if you're not yet an Audible member, my goodness, what's keeping you? Why don't you join Audible right now by going to audible.com/MacBreak. When you do, you could sign up to get a credit toward a book, a free book, so you can listen, and you know, no cost or obligation to you. And I tell you, you're going to find 45,000 titles that play, of course, on your iPod, so you can plug it in next time you fly Virgin Atlantic, or on any other, almost any other portable device, your iPhone, too. Andy, do you have a recommendation this week, or are you tapped out?
You know, I'll never tapped out. I'm recommending one of my favorite books of all time.
Wow.
It's by Jack London, one of the great American authors of the 20th century or any other century. It's called The Sea Wolf. This might be a novel that you were assigned to read in high school. Do not let that dissuade you. This is a great, great book. The basic thrust of the plot is that really, all I have to do is tell you the two main character names. There is this dude named Humphrey Van Weyden.
Sounds like Scott.
Exactly. He's riding the ferry across San Francisco Bay when the ferry crashes, and he's the only survivor. But fortunately, there's a ship that comes to rescue him. It's captained by Captain Wolf Larson, on a ship headed north to slaughter seals. The captain is one of his, he doesn't believe that there's an afterlife. He believes that you live for whatever's happening right in front of you right now. He beats his crew with iron and oaken cudgels. He is thrilled in his Wolf Larson way to be picking up this little milk-toasty little guy, because he sees himself as an intellectual, you know, who knows how life works. And finally, he has a way that he gets someone that he can challenge, not just physically, but also intellectually.
Tell me how much you like my poetry.
Exactly. He would be the Vogon captain, yeah. Only imagine he was like 7'8" and could, like, you know, bend a car in half. And so he says, no, hell no, I'm not taking you back to landfall. We've got this. We're headed to kill seals. If you want, you can either go back in the harbor, or we can make you the ship's cook. And so Humphrey Van Weyden has a little bit of an education in life. And it's just a nothing but this physical and intellectual showdown with one of the most brutal jerks in American literature.
It sounds like my first job, actually.
Yes. And then I said, Mr. Johansson, you know, you changed that fry medium.
Yeah.
I don't think that it's unsanitary. I'll give you back this paper hat and I can walk. I'm going to junior college.
How did you know? That was my first job.
Hey, it's very nice that we had a bathroom break.
He's feeling much better
astronaut
now.
Astronaut diapers. Next week's episode brought to you by astronaut diapers.
We could work on that. So our Audible pick, this sounds great, Andy. You know, it's funny. I've read The Call of the Wild and a bunch of other Jack London books, but I never read The Sea Wolf. I have to read this one.
I mean, Jack London, he's one of those authors where later on you realize how profoundly almost every other writer after him has been ripping him off.
Yeah.
There are so many mediocre books that were created when someone read a Jack London novel and said, God, I wish I could write half as good as that. And they wound up writing about one quarter as good as that.
Well, and then they've kind of got the rep of being kind of kids' books, which I'm sure they weren't when they came out.
Yeah, well, oh, God, no. Seawolf is not a kid's book. I mean, his most famous book is, of course, The Call of the Wild. And when it's, you know, so easy, when you have a story that's so easily adapted to a Disney, you know, animation,
right,
you know, yeah,
right.
It might get that kind of reputation. But no, The Seawolf is, it's brutal. It is unflinching. I think I read it when I was 17 or 18, and it created word pictures and imagery that I still stays with me to this day. I can still see, you know, the scene that he wrote where Humphrey is getting used to, like, his work as the ship's cook, and he knows that he has to now, it's important that he keep a sharp fillet knife at his side at all times to defend against attacks from everybody. And so he's trying to manage these pots while keeping a hand free for the knife at all times.
Oh,
I'm like, holy cow. I am not taking no ferry across no San Francisco
Mm-mm.
Bay. I'm telling you that.
Thank goodness they built the bridge. Let me play a little bit of it. This is from the Audible.com's edition of The Sea Wolf by Jack London. Garrick Hagen doing the reading, and I'll play a little bit of it for you right now.
Directly ahead and from very near at hand. Our paddle wheels.
There are a couple of different unabridged versions. Brian Emerson also does a good one.
Oh, do you like the Brian? Okay, yeah, this is actually, I should stop at the whistle. This is, I think, the abridged edition. So there's several different versions of it.
Yeah. Go for the unabridged.
You're right. I don't need, what was I thinking?
Don't need abridges.
That's what I was thinking. Crazy. All right, hey, great pick. That could, one of any 45,000 books could be yours. All you got to do is go to audible.com/MacBreak. We really, really love audible.com. I know you'll love audible.com, so give it a try. Make sure you use the special URL so we get the credit. And we thank Audible for their support of MacBreak Weekly. Let's see, what else is going on in the world of Macintosh? We could do our picks here, unless somebody has another story that they think is important. Are we?
I'd like to mention the stock price.
Is it rebounding?
It is, and it's rebounding on very strong iPod and Mac sales.
So when did they announce new sales?
I think it's a couple of days old. I got a thing from my broker, even though I'm not a stockholder anymore in Apple, but they had some sort of analyst walk through, and they mentioned some analysis of the Mac sales and iPods at very strong, and the call now is at 250. They're putting the price at 250.
Wow!
So that's a combination of people wanting to get in now that they know the profit takers took off after WWDC. There's always a bounce up after the profit taking. So some of it's from that, some of it's from strong sales, and some of it's from anticipation over the new analyst numbers on the iPhone at something like 9 million of the new ones alone.
Well, it's currently at 179, something like that. You sold it. So you sold at the peak. You sold it to 200.
I sold at 199.23.
So you're still ahead of the game.
But, yeah, I could still buy back in on the house money, but I won't.
It's making you crazy, I'm sure. I'm sure. So
this whole not being able to own stock because you're a journalist thing does make me itch.
Yeah, I bet it does. But I kind of like it, you know. It is
because now all the guys that used to say, "Well, you're just a fanboy. You just want your stock
exactly.
to go
up."
And I have this great line I give them now. I haven't owned Apple stock for more than 6 months. I just emptied your clip. What do you got next?
Well, that's good news. That's very good news.
That's kind of interesting to see that around now. There's still quite a bit of hubbub about Steve's health.
Yes, that hasn't died away, has it?
I've seen posts every single day, mostly amongst the people that I watch a lot of blogs that deal with the financial side of Apple, and there's just it's approaching hysteria in a few places.
You know, we talked about it a little bit on Twit as well, and it is a story that just won't die. But I think we also. By the way, we said last week that if because Apple's a publicly held company, if there's something wrong with Steve, they would have to disclose it. I asked Andrew Horowitz that of the Disciplined Investor. He said no. In fact, that's not the case. They are not obligated to because while we may think that the company lives and breathes and dies by Steve Jobs. That isn't necessarily the case. And so they're not, just because their CEO might be ill, they're not required to tell anybody.
But wouldn't it expose them if, as they did, they actually explicitly said, no, Steve isn't really sick. He just has a stomach flu or something?
Well,
you can always be sued. You can always be sued.
Silence is always defensible. An actual out-out lie, though,
I think we actually said that last week. Or when we talked about this last, Leo, was that it's not that they have to disclose it, but if they say he's cool when he's not, that could create,
right.
Certainly will create, I can guarantee you're right. I mean, it will create some investor lawsuits if that were the case.
We'd have to really
Whether
parse.
Or not they'll win, who knows?
We'd have to really parse what they said. Did they say he's okay or just that, he's got a little stomach flu, he's on
got
antibiotics.
A bug. Yeah. They said the bug, they were to use the bug.
But they didn't say he doesn't have anything else.
No, I think, it's like you said, anybody can. I mean, Apple sued, I think, hundreds of times a day. So, I mean, it's,
They have.
I think they just have a guy whose job it is to accept process. Yep, come on. Yeah, give it to me. Next. Yeah. Nice to see you, Henry.
They probably have a special door. Next. They have a special door, don't they, at One Infinity. That just, One Infinity Loop, it's the service processor entrance. Just go on in there.
Yeah, they have their own cafeteria over there, too.
We'll just sit here and wait. There'll be another one in a minute.
It's anyway, that's, to not, think huge, about that's what not Apple's going to do without Jobs too. The I just did an article on you know the whole Jobs health thing, particularly with the Street was talking about it, Jim Cramer.
Right.
And I was kind of looking at, I mean, we all remember the, you know, the Apple of the early 80s that as soon as Jobs left, you know, he kind of sucked a lot of talent out of Apple to work at Next. And then there was a series of CEOs that were bad, that made decisions that were not in the interest of the company. All those things are not exactly the same thing that's going to happen this time. This is not a kind of a fledgling company in a tech market that's kind of figuring things out as it was in the mid 80s as Apple fell and you know, and then over the next decade.
But who would lead Apple if Steve were gone? I mean, who's next in line?
Tim Cook. It depends on what you mean by lead. I think as CEO, very likely Tim Cook.
Who is
he's that? He's not charismatic. He's the COO. You see him very seriously looking. He's usually sitting next to Steve Jobs, you know, in various times when they make public appearances.
He's the guy who's running the joint.
Yeah, he's from HP or Compaq, I believe.
Oh, interesting.
They hired him in 1987. That's one of the first things Jobs did is brought him in to manage operations. Because remember, Apple had this terrible problem with too many performers, right, and not enough PowerBooks. And
right.
He really dialed things in.
He's done a good
in.
Job, and, actually.
Yeah. I mean, he's when you listen to Apple's, you know, the various, he's also in the stock when they do an annual report or quarterly report. He's always talking about the numbers and talking about how much inventory they have and how they hit, you know, within the target of their inventory or had lean inventory or whatever. He's likely the person that would kind of lead in that sense. But, you know, Steve Jobs has a, you know, a charisma and the kind of presenting that he does, that kind of portion, it will probably be taken over by Forstall, who's kind of,
or maybe Phil.
Yeah. I mean, Phil is a great, kind of forward Phil's personality.
He's a front guy. He's
funny and charming.
He's just a senior vice president. So that'd be a big promotion, but, you know, Schiller's been up there on stage with Jobs enough times that he knows the shtick, and you know, as for Tim's being you know real gregarious out there personality, if you know any COOs like that, I'd be interested in meeting them.
Well, it's interesting because it sounds like, contrary to what people might be thinking, that Steve has been given some thought to who might run Apple and has surrounded himself with people who could do the job.
And they said that in that many words. I mean,
he doesn't want to work there forever. Whether or not he's sick has got nothing to do with it. I mean, the guy's got enough money to do anything he wants when he wants. And he may want to stop someday.
When did he say that, Daniel?
The shareholder convention, that was one of the, or shareholder meeting in the spring. That was one of the concerns was about his health. And it typically, I think they brought it up before. And he answered that. I think it was pretty well reported at the time too, but he answered that in by saying, you know, we already have kind of a chain of command set up. There's a lot of people that could take over various roles that he does. So, obviously they've given a lot of thought to that because, I mean, his bout with cancer was in 2003 and that was 5 years ago. So they've had a lot of time to think about what comes next.
Right.
I have a blog here that, or actually a blog post by Apple Gazette that I remembered and pulled up. They have top five possible Steve Jobs successors: Tony Stark, aka Iron Man, Zeus, the WWE Ed McMahon guy, and the Emperor Palpatine from Star Wars.
Where are you getting this from? The chat room?
No, Apple Gazette. I remembered seeing this the other day, so I pulled it up. There it is.
Okay.
It's from March. It's old, but and then their number one choice would be a robo version of Steve.
Yeah. So anyway. Steve clone.
So how about a team, like a tag team presentation between Justin Long and John
Hodgman? Yeah.
Yeah. That'd be great.
I think they would be the new co-CEOs of the company.
They're like
24-hour shtick. Yeah.
The devil and the angel on Steve's shoulders going,
right.
I think you should make Windows versions of the programs. No, you shouldn't. What are you, crazy? So you're actually thinking that Jim Cramer is just kind of flogging the market, trying to stir up some drama here.
Well, I think he's putting so much attention upon, Steve Jobs' health fears because it's kind of an irrational thing. It's not something that you can publicly deny or you know, really clarify. It's right. Not like sales. You can't, the street has been publishing a lot of information that's very kind of sketchy about, remember last year they said that Apple was trying to sell a million iPhones over the first 2 days,
right?
And they failed to do that. That was just statistically impossible for Apple to do. And, you know, it didn't line up with anything that was happening in reality. And it was obviously just something that they put out there to make something really good look really bad.
Right.
And it was easy to deflate because you could logically point out, you know, this is what, that would not have been possible. Obviously Apple wasn't trying to do that. But when it comes to Jobs' health, what can anyone say to defend that? Because it's not known. And, you know, Jobs is kind of a,
it's sort of the Matt Fudge approach is what I call it.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I'm glad, Daniel, that you're kind of, read Daniel's article. It's a great article. I think you do a good job of making your case. And
well, I think he's wanting to install that as kind of a dial so that he can turn up the what if Jobs can't run Apple anymore, you should probably sell off all your stock. And he's really given a lot of advice that's been pretty traumatic, you know, traumatically bad over the last several years.
He does have one point regardless of how Apple would do without Steve Jobs, the stock price is going to be take a dive if Steve Jobs leaves or retires or falls ill.
And a major reason for that is because of all this hype saying this is the cause and effect. This has to happen. When in reality, I don't like one of the things that I point out in that article is there's a lot of things that are not going to be impacted if Steve Jobs retired or, you know, if he became too sick to run the company in the immediate future. People are not going to stop going to the Apple store. They're not going to like start buying Vista. They're not going to look for a phone that is less capable than the iPhone.
Zune sales triple overnight.
Right. You know, it's like, oh, no, there's no Steve Jobs. I'm going to have to get, you know, a Motorola Q.
Well,
Kramer's been in trouble before, too. You know,
we know. Oh, I know. And it's amazing that, frankly, the guy's still working. Yeah. But he's funny. He's entertaining. And he certainly keeps stuff volatile and happening. And, you know, I think I'm not going to ascribe any monetary motives to him. You don't need to. It's showbiz.
I just say that he is to stock picking what wrestling is, what pro wrestling is to sport.
Yeah. You know, he's hitting buttons and screaming and yelling and, you know, I mean, it's just showbiz. I know a little bit about that. I got some buttons here I can press. let's get to our picks of the week because we're running out of time. Yeah, I don't know if I didn't warn you about this, Daniel, but we like to pick a software product or something that we've been using a lot that we like to recommend to our friends. I'll give you a minute to compose yourself to think about it, and I'll start with our good friend Scott Bourne. Anything that's Scott, actually, I'm going to preface this, and I apologize. I should have done this week. Alex Lindsay was circulated an email to us saying he'd been hanging out with some developers, and he was kind of shocked to find out that they actually pay attention to this pick. They hope that they will be picked. It means a big deal. It means a lot to them to get picked on this show. And I think we've just been kind of treating it as, you know, hey, here's something cool that we like. And I think Scott, you and Alex kind of said maybe we should pay more attention to what we're picking here.
Yeah, it humbled me. I forget this. I mean, you know, we do this show. I mean, people may not understand. I mean, I come over to the studio and hang out. We're off mic. We're still talking about this stuff.
Right.
I mean,
this is just what we do.
What we do. So, you know, for us, it's like we're a bunch of pals getting together to talk about stuff we're interested in. And we forgot, oh, yeah, there's hundreds of thousands of people listening. But it did humble me to think about it. And I decided, you know, to be more careful about it. And this week, I was going to pick a cool camera strap. But then I thought about the developers. So I picked a site that's in beta. And I think it might be closed. I'm going to give a code that might work here on the show, which might certainly close the
Well,
beta.
I'm really glad you put a lot of thought in this, Scott.
It's Faux Trade is my pick of the week.
Faux Trade. P-H-O or F-A-U-S?
P-H-O-T-R-A-D-E in Wheel of Fortune missing vowel vein. It's not Photo Trade. It's Faux Trade. Okay. And this is a new site, a new photography site. Of course, that's got my interest immediately. And I've posted some images there and have started a gallery there. They're trying to kind of do a combination of Flickr and iStock, with some more stuff thrown in. But those are the two most recognizable flares to it. The difference being, if you look at iStock, iStock's pretty much done from the photo buyer's perspective. Everything that happens at iStock is kind of done to benefit the buyer. And Fotrade's doing it to benefit the photographer. So there's more money to photographers. There are tools that are designed from a photographer's point of view. Much better protection, for instance. They have some algorithms built to make it harder for people to steal your photos. It's really kind of well thought. Now, it is a beta product. So, and when I actually talked with them last week, and you know, they're like, by the way, we're really a beta. And so we're going to give you some invite codes, but we really want people to come help us make it better, not just slam us because it isn't perfect on day one.
Cool.
So should I give out that invite code?
Yeah, please do. Shash, write this down. Put this in the show notes.
It's TWIP, not to be confused with TWIT because of, you know, Alex and I doing the This Week in Photography show,
right,
TWIP.
Right.
So it may still work. It may not. I make no promises. But if you want to try it as a photographer, you can use the code TWIP and see if you can get in on the closed beta. If not, just go browse it. There's a lot of photographs up there. And it's a very interesting model, unlike anything I've seen so far. It's different from Zoomer. It's different from, you know, PBase. It's different from Flickr. It's different from iStock. It kind of incorporates versions of all those things. And it's free.
It's kind of funny that you should pick that, because my pick is a photo pick, too. Is that funny?
Oh, what do you know?
Yeah, and similar in some ways. You know that yesterday, the founders of Flickr joined the mass exodus from Yahoo. Katarina Fake and Stuart Butterfield, who created Flickr, sold it to Yahoo. Now, I think Yahoo has been a good steward for Flickr, and I'm not saying that Flickr is going to suddenly go bad because Katarina and Stuart left. But it did prompt a lot of articles about, well, what if you didn't want to use Flickr, or if Flickr did start going downhill, or if Yahoo, you know, got sold to Microsoft, what would you use instead? And I've been using a kind of a Flickr alternative. There are a number of other choices. There's Zoomer and PhotoBuck and so forth. But I've been using one that I just think is great from the McCaskills. It's called SmugMug. And I'm sure you've seen SmugMug.
Oh, yeah.
It's not free. This is the negative. If you're a Flickr Pro user, and I think anybody who's serious about Flickr, it's comparable in price to Flickr Pro. There are several layers or stages or tiers of pricing, but it's, you know, $30, $40, $50, and $60. I bought the top of the line because with it you can store high-quality video on there, and I don't mean flash video. I mean high-quality QuickTime videos on there. It is really nice to if you pay for the slightly higher tier, because you can integrate it into your site. So SmugMug, just like Flickr, allows you to upload your photos, display them, tag them, pretty much all of the same, you know, create albums, same kinds of features. But it integrates right into my site so nicely. With a little bit of CSS, I have the same menu structure and so forth. So if you go to leolaporte.smugmug.com, which is my SmugMug address, you'll see it actually looks like it's my website. In fact, if you click any of the menus on there, it is exactly the same as my website. It has the same background, has the same everything. It's integrated into my website. So I really like it for that reason. Instead of using something like Coppermine to create a PHP-based photo gallery on my website, I just use SmugMug. SmugMug has spent all of their energy and time on making photo viewing easier. So they have all sorts of sizes you can look at. They have really great Ajax-y controls for it. You can do a thumbs up, thumbs down in the photo rank. The photo info is all there, all the XF information, and even more. And I think a much nicer, frankly, display than Flickr. I think it's a little bit easier to use. You could save the photos right from the site. And if you're a pro, you can sell photos there. They do prints. They will do all the e-commerce back end. So it's designed to, you know, a lot of pro photographers are starting to use SmugMug as kind of their back end for their e-commerce and their photo albums. I'm really happy with SmugMug. And so if you do feel like, well, with Katarina and Stuart leaving Yahoo, with Yahoo's, you know, leaving Flickr, with Flickr being, you know, Yahoo being kind of struggling along, this is something you might want to take a look at as an alternative. There is a free trial version, but ultimately you have to pay for the pro version. I kind of like that. I feel like they've got a business model, you know, and you don't have to worry about a lot of ads on there. What is missing is that Flickr community, and there's nothing that can replace it. So you'll notice on my website under the photos menu, I do have both SmugMug and Flickr, and I continue to post to Flickr. SmugMug also has a lot of nice interfaces over to other people's sites and ways to get lots of different ways to upload and so forth. Some commenting. I don't think the commenting is quite as good as the Flickr commenting. It's more album specific than it is photo specific. So again, it doesn't support that community in the same way that Flickr does. But if you just want a great photo album for your website or a way to store your photos and share them with family and friends, or even sell them and print them, SmugMug, SmugMug.com. I don't have a coupon code for you, but they do have a 30-day, I think, free trial.
They're not in closed beta, are they?
No, they are not. They've been around for a while. And I just like these guys, and they have a good, solid
my
business
coupon
model.
My coupon code isn't a code to save you money or anything. It just gets you into a
bank. Get you in the door, yeah. So take a look at SmugMug. Andy Inocco. We got a bunch of photographers here. We're all photographers. Isn't that funny?
That's right. We don't like to engage. We simply like to document.
That's probably why. that's probably why, yeah.
A listener sent me a link to something really, really cool. I'm broadcasting from the Mom Resort and Casino in suburban Boston, Massachusetts. Normally I'm out on the front porch where there's lots and lots of birds, giving us their opinions of the new iPhone from the bushes and the trees. And someone sent me a link to a library of bird sounds assembled by Cornell University, the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. And boy, did I really, really enjoy this site. It has, it's a group by regions of the United States. It was such a great thing to play with because I've lived in the same 2-3 counties for most of my life. I've been hearing most of the same bird songs, and it's only, recently, only at 10 minutes after finding this, being given this URL, that I now know that it's the black-capped chickadee that makes the fee-bee-bee song. It's the blue jay that does that da-da-da-da-da-da-da sound. I've gotten them all wrong all my life. Of course, I have not been terribly interested in the bird sounds. Just, okay, I believe that's some sort of bird, I believe.
This is the fee-bee-bee sound, I believe, that you were referring to, the black cap chickadee.
Yes.
All I like. That is piercing.
That is, well, you'll find them if you're interested in chickadee for dinner tonight. You'll be able to track those down and shoot them. They're very, very small. Although it is cool in that I believe, according to the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, it is the only Eastern United States bird species whose bird call is named after a Don Martin sound effect. So.
Oh. Yeah.
I believe that is the sound of cockroaches underneath a board being stepped on.
Fee-bee-bee?
Oh, wasn't that an ABBA song, too?
Fee-bee-bee.
Oh, don't.
Da-da-da-da, fee-bee-bee. I think that's just their English for something else. They were Swedish. Fee-bee-bee.
Now, the sad news is that they also have, the URL is kind of long. It's www.birds.cornell.edu/Macaulay Library/freesounds. You'll have the link up on the Twit site. The sad thing is that they have, it's part of an even larger library at animalbehaviorarchive.org, all one word. And you look at the front page and you're like, oh my God, best of the collections, organized under courtship, stalking, territory defense, communication, marine animals. There's a direct link to the popular harp seal pup sound, which would probably fit in very well with our Audible pick of the week. And so you're really, cancel the dental appointment. I'm going to be spending the rest of the afternoon listening to these animal recordings and videos. And then you realize that it's all in real player format. And if I had 2 hours left to live, it might be worth the trouble for the rest of my life to have Real Player on my computer. They also have something called the Raven Viewer. So you click on that and it wants to install some other sort of plugin. So you're more like, you know what? I'm really not as interested in the false killer whale sounds as I once was. So too bad there. But the free bird sounds are all in .wav format. So you can just click on them and play.
That's great.
I do want to say about that site, as an ornithologist, there's a lot of information there, not just sounds, but pictures and incredible information. If you're into birds, that's the place.
Oh, yeah. I forgot. You're a big birder, aren't you, Scott?
I am.
Yeah.
I have a life list even.
Well, and your life list is photos.
My life list, yeah. For a bird to make it on my life list, I have to have a full frame photo of it.
Yeah, and some beautiful pictures. We did a little Twit Live thing with Scott and his bird pictures. It just blew me away. Blew me away. Where are those online?
They're avianstock.com. AVIANSTOCK.com. But I, like Andy, I could spend many hours on this site.
Yeah, now you have the scottborn.com site, so maybe we'll get some bird pictures there, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very cool. Fee-bee-bee. Hey, I do actually. It turns out I do have a Smug Mug coupon code. Anybody who's on Smug Mug has a Smug Mug coupon code. I didn't realize that. But the thing is, it's so long. It's kind of a lengthy thing. You could just use my email, leo@leoville.com, and that would work. And then you get, I think you have $5 off, something like that.
Yeah, the people from Smug Mug were listening to the show, and somebody yelled quickly, "Oh my God, get a go to Leo now.
Give him a code. Give him a code right now." Somebody said if you use a coupon code Flickr, you get 50% off. So obviously Smug Mug is, that's probably a better coupon code than mine. Smug Mug is attempting to capitalize on this Flickr flight. Daniel, did we gave you enough time to come up with a pick, something you'd like to tell people about that you think is really cool?
Well, I think it's kind of a, earlier this week, I kind of blew down the Sprout Car website. yeah. They're hosted on Dreamhost.
Yeah.
And I totally took it offline for the day. So I thought now that they're back up, I could use that as my pick.
Great idea.
Yeah. The secret install code is sudo jim install Sprout Car. You can type that into your CLI and
secret password
magically appears in your computer.
So it's not sproutcore.org, it's sproutcore.com.
Yes.
And there's demos. As you mentioned, there's that photo, iPhoto demo is very cool that Chris Breen was talking about. That you can download stuff. But it's if you're on a Mac, as I know you all are, you've already got Ruby. So you just use Gem to install it. And that's very cool. And you can start writing SproutCore code right now.
Kind of more information about the company behind it and the developers behind it, it's Sproutit. Sproutit.com. They have another blog that kind of mentions some interesting things about Sprout Core and some of the people that are using it and how it works and how it interfaces with different browsers to kind of abstract the differences and say how IE and how Firefox and Safari present JavaScript, the data models that they use internally and how Sprout Core just kind of acts as a layer above that so developers can build on top of it in a way that doesn't break in different browsers. And so it kind of explains a lot of interesting background on what's going on and what they're continually updating about what's happening in the future too.
Yeah. Well, I think this is a first because everybody recommended a website. I don't think that's ever happened before on this show.
Well, we were appropriately, chased because of
The developers are going, wait a minute, didn't you want to pick an app? No.
Well, the thing is, though, the developers developed the website. So.
That's right. There's still a developer. And I do want to mention roughlydrafted.com, the Roughly Drafted magazine, which is increasingly on my must-read list. Some great articles Daniel's writing on. Is it just you, Daniel, or you have some help on that?
I have people send in information that lets me in on what's happening in different areas. Sometimes I've had people kind of co-write articles with me or do some fact-checking and research that they've forwarded in.
Well, you put a lot of effort into it, especially I especially like all the links at the break, which really make it easy to kind of do more, and yet they don't interrupt the flow of it. I think it's really a nice idea, very nicely done.
Yeah, I try to prevent saying the same things over and over too many times, so I kind of reference the article that I've already broached the subject in.
Right, very good. roughlydrafted.com. Now, I'm sorry that we lost Chris Breen. He seemed to have fallen off the internet, so we can't get a pick from Mr. Breen. Skype is being unruly. We might try Uvu. I was going to make that a kind of a subsidiary pick because it is Mac, Windows compatible. The Mac version is in beta and not quite as capable as the Windows version. And much to my annoyance, the Mac version, you can't buy the full feature set that you can, even though the full feature set is available for the first 30 days, they for some reason don't sell it. Well, while they do sell it on Windows, which I guess tells me it's just not finished yet. But we're gonna take a look at starting to use Uvu for shows like this where we have multiple people. We want to see everybody because, like iChat, you can have multiple video screens, up to 6 video screens, unlike iChat.
How do you spell that?
OOVOO.com. And I'd like you guys to...
It's a palindrome.
That'd be really good with Drobo.
Yeah, Drobo and Uvu.
Drobo session.
Uvu Drobo. OOVOO.com. I'd like you to try it, and maybe we can do a test case and just see how it works. The problem I've had with iChat is you have to have so much bandwidth. It's really the multiple video thing is really, I think, designed for a LAN, not designed for over the internet because it requires such a huge amount of bandwidth. Looks good, but I just don't have enough bandwidth to do it yet. Hey, thank you, everybody, for being here. Chris Breen, I'm sorry we lost you. Thank you for joining us. Chris Breen is the Mac Daddy. You find him at Macworld Magazine. He does the Mac 911 column and, of course, is a regular on the iLife Zone and many other great podcasts. This Week in Photography is where you'll find Scott Bourne, among other places, but his new site, scottbourne.com, is really a locus for them all. That's his Tumblr.
It's very cool. I like Tumblr.
Tumblr's great, isn't it? If you want to add comments to that, you may not. I mean, that's one of the things about Tumblr that's, you know, cool.
I do.
You know,
how do I do that?
Yeah, Discuss, DISQUS.com.
Discuss.
It's a blog. It's a blog commenting system that I started using on leoville.com. At first with some trepidation thinking, wait a minute, I want to own these comments. But I really realized quickly that you don't own comments. Comments are a very valuable part of the blog ecosystem. And a commenter is really as much a blogger by couple. But at least you want to encourage intelligent comments in your blogs. And Discuss is very cool. It has threading. It has karma, so you can vote up and down. You can even bury people if they make a lot of stupid comments. The other readers of your blog can. Great anti-spam filtering. And it works with Tumblr. A lot of people on Tumblr are using it. So DISQUS.com.
Thank you.
And TWIP and ScottBourne.com. And, of course, Andy Anatko has the Celestial Waste of Bandwidth, CWOB.com, and you can see him in the Chicago Sun-Times and also on the Apple Phone Show and many other places.
Yes.
Yes, and on the ukulele as well. Did you ever have a ukulele band?
No, because I can never get one of those fake handlebar mustaches going.
Sweet Adeline.
I'm just a vagabond.
Well, we thank you all for being here. We hope we'll see you again next week. Another Mac Break is broke.